Please the court. Your Honors, my name is Mark Batten. I represent the defendants appellants in this case. The district court has ordered the parties to prepare for a class action trial without knowing what the issues are to be tried, how the case will be tried, or even who is in the class. The district court's order, therefore, violates Federal Rule Civil Procedure 23C1B and should be reversed. First, as to the district court's failure to identify the issues, which is one of the most significant problems for the parties going forward and for the absent members of the class.
What's so difficult about the issue? Were they entitled to overtime pay or not?
Well, as to that hourly class, Your Honor, were they entitled to overtime pay or not is an issue. But first
it's
of all,
issue, isn't it?
Well, the district court didn't mention it, first of all.
What was the district court mentioned in the order on the last page of the order?
No, Your Honor, there was no issue stated. There was a class definition stated on the last page of the order.
Didn't the orders talk about who were subject to defendants' unlawful compensation policies of failing to pay overtime compensation, et cetera, for all hours worked in excess of 40 per work week?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. In defining the class, the court mentions this policy, but also says in the order that whether this policy even existed or not is an issue for trial. And so the court did identify one thing that we know will be tried, which is whether Citizens had a policy of denying overtime to people. But that doesn't fit the requirements of 23C1B for a couple of reasons. For example, there is no mention in the district court's order anywhere of whether the plaintiff's prima facie case is an issue for the class trial. Plaintiffs have to prove that they worked more than 40 hours and therefore are entitled to overtime. Court doesn't tell us whether that's going to be decided on an individual basis or whether somehow we can conclude from a testimony, presumably of some sample of plaintiffs, that everybody in the class consistently worked more than 40 hours. That's part of the problem with this case.
They put an expert on who would say, I've studied all the records and, you know, it's a qualified expert under Daubert, and the expert says 85% of these people were working more than 40 hours a week.
But it's their burden, Your Honor, at class certification to show that they can do that, and they haven't done it. What they've presented is a tiny sample of declarations, tiny sample of the overall class, fill-in-the-blank form declarations prepared by plaintiff's counsel in which they said, I worked more than 40 hours from 96 people out of a class of thousands. There is no expert declaration before the court that says that's a good sample.
Well,
that's represented.
Some discovery you can ask that the class be decertified.
We certainly can, Your Honor, but Rule 23 requires that at the time of certification, and this is the essence of the Wachtell decision from the Third Circuit, at the time of certification, the court has got to take a hard look and say, are we just going to be facing a motion for decertification down the road, or does this class really hang together?
I don't think what's happened here is that far removed from what Wachtell said that is required.
Well, let me try to address that, Your Honor. Turning, for example, to the assistant branch manager class, again, focusing on the issues, it's clear that the district court didn't even intend to give us a complete list of the issues for trial, which Wachtell specifically says the rule requires, because all the court mentioned with respect to the assistant branch manager class is what is the primary duty of those individuals. That's one prong of the exemption, the executive exemption, the administrative exemption. What about discretion and independent judgment? That's a requirement that we will have to show also. How is that going to be tried? And how can we show on a class-wide basis that these individuals, each assistant branch manager at each of hundreds of branches, exercise discretion and independent judgment? The court doesn't mention it. There is no attempt, not even an attempt by the district court, to say, here are the issues for trial. Here is what we're going to do. She mentions one in passing in the course of the predominance analysis, but never says, this is what the trial looks like. And the Third Circuit in Wachtell said, that's not enough. That's what district courts routinely have done in the past. We say that's not enough because the rule says define the class, define the issues that are going to be tried. And the court did not even attempt it. The same thing with respect to the hourly class. Again, as I said, no mention of the plaintiff's prima facie case. So we are left to guess about how this case is going to be tried. Plaintiffs have never even told us, is there common evidence? Is there some evidence that's going to come in that will clearly apply to the whole class, or are they going to just call in a number of hourly employees, assistant branch managers, who are going to say, it happened to me, my branch manager told me not to record my overtime?
Counselor, I'd like to ask you to go back to Rule 23C, and in particular, can you tell me whether or not you read the rule as requiring the court to identify all class claims or at least a class claim?
The rule doesn't say either some or all. It says the class claims. And the Third Circuit in Wachtell looked at that specifically and said that definite article, the, is an indication that the list has to be complete. And the reason the court said that, I'm sorry.
When it says complete, are you saying that you are limited to the claims the court identifies, or if the court if there are multiple claims, a class member or a class can only proceed on what has been identified by the court?
That's correct, Your Honor. That
is. So if there are multiple class claims and the court identifies merely one, that doesn't mean the court has erred, right?
No, the court has erred because it has not set out all of the claims that will be tried. And Wachtell says the court has to do that.
Well, couldn't it also mean that you could only try the claim identified by the court?
Well, if that's going to be the decision, that is to say the only issue for those assistant branch managers at trial will be primary duty, because that's the only one that the district court identified, then the class action mechanism a superior mechanism for resolving these cases when lots of things that determine the defendant's liability are relegated to individual cases? That is to say, there is no advantage in trying, leave aside the question of whether primary duty can even be decided on a class basis. That's a separate issue. But even if it could, that is, without any question, one of three prongs of the executive exemption. And if what the district court is saying, well, we're just going to try primary duty on a class basis, and then what, call in every assistant branch manager as to discretion and independent judgment? Where is the advantage in that? That clearly violates Rule 23b-3, which requires that common issues predominate and that the class action mechanism be the superior method for resolving the claims. So we have assumed right along that the district court did not mean that anything not mentioned in the opinion will be tried individually. That couldn't be sustained.
Counsel, how is the case pending before the Supreme Court now in Walmart impact this case?
It very well may, Your Honor. One of the issues is not implicated here, which is the question about Rule 23b-2 and to what extent damages claims or back pay claims can be included in a b-2 class. That is not presented here. Plaintiffs have always proceeded on a b-3 basis. However, the essence of Walmart's position before the Supreme Court is that the decisions that are being challenged are decisions that were made on an individual store level pursuant to a policy of subjectivity that allowed each store manager to decide pay and promotion claims for the individuals in that store. This case is exactly like that, because what the plaintiffs say here as to the hourly employees is, my branch manager told me not to record my time. My branch manager deleted my overtime from the system after I recorded it. My branch manager did this and that. With respect to the assistant branch managers, although if you look in the supplemental appendix to the plaintiff's brief, page SA3, the job description for assistant branch manager says, manage the branch as permitted by the branch manager. Supervise employees to the extent permitted by the branch manager. That's what this case is about. It is a collection of 1,000 different individuals saying, my branch manager did this to me. Just like in Walmart, where the plaintiffs there are saying, my store manager failed to promote me because I am a woman. And the objections that Walmart raised before the Supreme Court as to the individuality of that case are directly analogous to the situation here. Turning from the issues to the class definition, the class, as Your Honor pointed out, is defined in terms of an open liability question, which courts in this circuit have said is not an appropriate class definition because we have to try the case to find out who's in the class. The plaintiffs, interestingly, in their brief, do not even defend the order as written, the class definition as written. They say, just ignore that limitation in the district court's definition, take out that reference to liability, and let's have the class be all hourly retail employees, all assistant branch managers. And the problem with that, of course, is that that results in a dramatically overbroad class. Again, because of the individuality of these claims, we're now sweeping in lots of individuals, thousands of individuals, not shown to have any claim because they haven't even come forward to say, I had a branch manager who did this to me. So that's exactly like the Oshana case, which we've mentioned in our briefs. Plaintiffs responded. Let me briefly address that. In Oshana, the claim, it was a product liability claim where plaintiffs indicated that they had been deceived by the inclusion of an additional sweetener in Diet Coke. And this court said, that can't be certified as a class. We don't know if people were deceived. We don't know if people maybe liked that other sweetener in the Fountain Diet Coke. This class doesn't hang together. This is not a case where the individual's state of mind is relevant, of course. But this is a case where individual facts determine liability. And the essence of a class action, let me put it this way. The essence of a class action is if we try this case as to one individual or a handful of individuals or some manageable number before the district court, whatever result the fact finder gets to there can be fairly applied to everybody else in the class. And that's exactly the way the plaintiffs want to try this case. But here, if we did that, it wouldn't work because the resolution of one or any number of individuals' claims, credibility judgments about whether their branch manager really did the things that they allege, would tell you nothing about the next plaintiff who's going to come in from a different branch and say, my branch manager did this or that. For example, one of the things in the briefs, and it's mentioned in the district court's order, is that the records show that there were some adjustments to time that had been recorded in the payroll system, and then later it's changed. Well, okay, but the district court even drops a footnote and says, we don't know yet whether those time adjustments were inappropriate. It may be that somebody recorded time that they didn't actually work, and the branch manager went back in and fixed that. The only way to know whether those time adjustments were unlawful is to look at each individual case. And that's the problem with this case as a class action. Not technically before this court right now because the court granted review limited to the question of compliance with 23C1B. But the issue is, what are we going to do with this class definition? That's the issue that is before this court. And it defines the class in terms of liability.
The case was brought under Fair Labor Standards Act and the Illinois Minimum Wage Law.
Yes, it was.
This appeal is based on the one that certified classes under Illinois Minimum Wage Law.
That's right, Your Honor.
What about the other, what happened with the other Fair Labor Standards Act?
In terms of what has happened in the court, not that much. The case is in discovery. We have deadlines later this summer for that, and presumably there will be a motion to decertify that class as well, which is the way.
There was a class certified in that.
Conditionally certified without the court didn't even wait for an opposition brief from us, simply conditionally certified the class, sent notice out to everyone without consideration of who was appropriately in the case or not.
That matters not on appeal here.
I'm sorry?
That matters not on appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor. This is limited to the Illinois class that was certified under Rule 23. One other point that the plaintiffs make a lot out of, I want to address briefly, is the notion that the defendants classified all the assistant branch managers as exempt. And that uniform classification is enough to have the class hang together. Again, not what the district court did, because the district court tied the class definition to liability. But that job description can't be enough, because it's true, the bank did define all of its assistant branch managers as exempt, but the job description is based on what they should be doing. And again, if you review those job descriptions, you'll see that they defer everything to the branch manager and say, manage, supervise as permitted by your branch manager. And liability in this case turns not on the job description, what you should be doing, but what you actually did do on a day-to-day basis. That's clear from the case law. It's clear from the Department of Labor's opinion letters. Whether an individual is exempt or not is an individualized analysis. My time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Donahue.
May it please the court, counsel. Again, I feel compelled to talk about what this appeal should not be about. In particular, when the defendant filed their petition for review under 23F, they set forth six particular reasons as to why this court should accept this appeal and review it, review the judge's decision. Two of those reasons was you cannot try the hourly group of employees as a class-wide claim, and the other one was you can't try the exemption issue for the assistant branch managers as a class-wide claim. The panel of three judges that reviewed that petition rejected that as an argument to be raised on appeal. They were very specific and said the sole issue on appeal here is whether or not the text of this judge's order met the requirements of Rule 23C1B, the text of the order. So we are looking at the four corners of the document. And starting off with the four corners of the document, this court's going to need to ask itself a question. When we issue this order related to this appeal, what's the purpose? Are we wanting to develop and send a message to the district court judges what in particular we would like for them to include in their court orders under Rule 23C1B? And if that's the case, is there anything out there that gives us some guidance on what we need to say? The only thing that this court has issued is the Spano versus Boeing decision that addressed how a court defined the class under Rule 23C1B. It did not discuss the issues of defining the class claims or class defenses. And I think, as the court's probably noted, in the legal briefs filed by both parties, the Wachtell decision out of the Third Circuit appears to be the only circuit court that's kind of discussed what's required in the text of the order under 23C1B. And that court in particular wrote a thorough opinion, if you may recall, because it said it acknowledged that there apparently was an issue within that circuit amongst the district courts of not doing a very good job in setting forth and describing what the class claim, the class issues, and class defenses are. So what this court needs to do is say, are we going to look at Wachtell and maybe adopt the standards that are in that particular opinion and apply them to the district courts in this circuit? It's hard to say because I don't know if this court's had a continuing issue with class definitions of the claims and defenses. But if it does accept the Wachtell opinion, what does Wachtell mean? Well, since Wachtell has been issued, two subsequent opinions have gone before the Third Circuit to review whether or not the court had met the requirements. The first one is Nafar that's cited, and the second one is the Constar opinion. One of them, they said, no, you didn't meet the standards. One of them said, yes, you did. And looking at Wachtell and looking at Nafar, it's very blatant that those courts didn't even attempt to describe what the claims of the case were. They basically made generalized statements that, yes, all these class members have the same claims, but didn't go forward to describe what they even were. Or they said, yes, Mr. Nafar has described six different common claims, but then he failed to say which one of those applied to the class as a whole. Or they made general statements that, yes, there is a common defense amongst the whole class, but they failed to even describe what that common defense is. In this particular case, that doesn't exist. If Judge Lefkoe's opinion went before the Third Circuit, it would easily, in my opinion, survive the Wachtell standards. So if this court were to adopt those standards, I think it should be considered that she's passed them with flying colors.
So what do you look to in her decision as a list of claims that will proceed?
Regarding the hourly employee class, Your Honor, there is one claim, and that claim is that this company, that this bank, had a policy of requiring their hourly employees to work off the clock without pay. That is the claim. Now, defendants do briefly state, well, you just can't rely on what's stated in the complaint. You just can't do that, and I would agree with that. I mean, there may have been a day a while back where plaintiff's counsel could come forward and say, look, in our complaint we pled a very specific class-wide common claim. That may be the case, but you have to do a little bit more than that, and this judge did do more than that. She didn't just rely on our allegations in our complaint. We had sworn statements from individuals that worked at 83% of all the Illinois bank branches. Okay? Of those persons, 78% of them testified that when they were told, you're not going to get your overtime that you're working, the boss that told them that said, I'm telling you this because it's the bank policy. We had a branch manager and four assistant branch managers come forward from Illinois, all testifying that this is the company policy. We're not going to pay for the overtime if you work them. It's just going to happen on occasion. So just to state that this is simply a case relying upon a very small sampling of folks that work at the Illinois branches, and it doesn't involve testimony from management, that's not correct. It does involve testimony from management. So regarding the hourly class of employees, that is the claim. Regarding the assistant branch managers, the claim is we work more than 40 hours a week and we weren't paid overtime. Done. That's the prima facie case. It's very obvious that that's the case. I don't think the judge needed to express that there was evidence to support that, because quite honestly, the defendant has never presented any evidence to contradict that. I mean, it's pretty much admitted they treat all these employees as salary exempt and don't pay them overtime for hours worked over 40.
And I note the order also included a reference to a total of going back a total of 3 years.
Correct.
Why so?
Well, and that was something in the actual complaint. When the complaint was filed, we made reference for 3 years back. Under the Illinois minimum wage law, that's the furthest you can go back to make a claim for lost compensation under those laws. So, you know, regarding that class definition, it's, you know, there may be some notion that the defendants argue that I'm attempting to piece together certain things within the court's order in order to provide what the definition of the class is. Well, it's pretty obvious. I mean, she does it herself. I mean, she says the non-exempt employees include these six particular hourly employees who worked at Illinois bank branches within 3 years. That's a very well-defined class. There's no issues here about some blurry vision on what kind of res judicata may have an effect down the road. I mean, these people are well-defined. They're the ones that are in those particular six positions at these particular branches in this particular state. Going back to the assistant branch managers, regarding that class, they've asserted the affirmative defense that an exemption applies. This is their burden to prove at trial. Okay? They have a company-wide policy that says all of these employees, no matter where they work, the size of the branch, what their branch manager lets them do and doesn't let them do, they have decided that all of these employees are exempt under the Illinois minimum wage law. They have decided that all these employees do pretty much the same thing every day, that they gave them the same job title, same job categorization as being exempt, same job description, and even more importantly, those much more detailed daily job expectations. This is what you will be doing every day.
Are there any statistics on the percentage of cases that settle after a court certifies a class?
None that I'm aware of. None that I've researched.
One of the unwritten thing that's going on here in this whole class action area is that once you certify a class, and I think you mentioned there was a time when this would not have been here. This appeal, the interlocutory appeal in a case like this, but that once there's a certification order, there's this enormous pressure to settle rather than engage in years of expensive discovery, and a lot of meritless cases get settled just because it's a dollar cents thing to do. What are the chances of this case settling if the Judge Lefkoe's order is affirmed?
It'd be hard for me to speculate, but in my opinion, Your Honor, since I believe we have a very strong case against them for misclassification, I think it would be wise for them to look at that. That said, a good friend and colleague of mine in Kansas City, George Hansen, after finishing 5 years of litigation, just tried a class action case. It was under the FLSA against Tyson Chicken in front of, I think it was Judge Martin in Kansas City. So these do go to trial. This has been a contentious case. It has been litigated very heavily by the defendant.
He's not the 103-year-old judge in Kansas City.
No, he's not. I don't believe he is. So basically, you know,
this guy really takes life 10 years.
And in this case, I have three other cases involving these same defendants regarding their Citizens Bank branches in three other federal courts. So this has been contentious litigation. That was one of the arguments they raised in trying to get this court to accept the appeal, which was this would force us into settlement. Once again, that was something that was rejected.
Let me ask you the same question I asked your opposing counsel. What's the implication of Walmart, potential decision of Walmart?
Well, I thought it was kind of interesting you asked that question because Mark and I have actually been just emailing each other back and forth, just commenting about it, because I saw a remark was quoted in Law 360, a publication that comes out on the Internet. He was interviewed about possible implications from Walmart. My belief is that Walmart will most likely, if it comes down, be narrowly tailored to Title VII cases and to Title VII cases under B2. Now, this is just pure speculation. I think most lawyers are going to believe it's going to be a 5-4 vote one way or the other. My guess is it's probably going to be 5-4 in favor of Walmart if I were a betting man. But that said, I think in order to get to that 5-4 vote, the court's probably going to have to reach some consensus amongst themselves, which will probably be to narrowly tailor it to Title VII cases under Rule 23, something I avoid like the plague because they are difficult because they do rely on intent, actual intent. This case does not. This case relies on company policies that I believe we have established sufficient evidence.
I thought, not being that well acquainted with Walmart, though, that the oral argument talked about company policies versus policies in the field. That's not part of that case?
That probably is part of the case. I think, like most companies, they have a wonderful policy written on paper, and the real issue is there is what's its application. In that particular case, it's fair promotion for women, et cetera. But the practice that actually occurs out in the branches, I think they also admitted that the plaintiff's counsel in that case admitted that the store managers had broad discretion in whether or not on who to promote and who not to promote, which seemed to kind of contradict their argument that there was commonality of a company-wide policy, which I thought was an interesting approach by plaintiff's counsel, perhaps one I would not have taken.
Did you tender to the judge the proposed class and class claim language that was set out in the order?
In the particular motion itself, Your Honor, I believe that we pulled the class definition of the class from what we used in our complaint. Regarding the class claim, that was something that we obviously argued when talking about commonality, typicality, and predominance. And again, that's something that, within the order itself, she, reiterated the same claims for both classes throughout her analysis of Rule 23A and 23B3. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Are you happy with the way the language appears in the decision?
Well, Your Honor, 2020 obviously provides some of the best hindsight. Would I have drafted it more detailed, the definition itself? Possibly. But the question before this court is the manner in which she did it enough to pass the muster of 23C1B, and I think it is. And finally, they're asking this court to actually reverse her opinion, to throw out her class certification order. Again, that's something beyond the scope of the appeal, in my opinion. But in order to do that, they've got to show an abuse of discretion. And I didn't see them arguing abuse of discretion on her part anywhere in their briefing. And as this court has stated, the abuse of discretion is extremely high. I cited a case, I can't remember the name of it, but it likened it to the camel passing through the eye of the needle. It is something that's very difficult to do. All the other cases where this topic came up under Rule 23C1B, even some of the cases where a very, very weak attempt was made to define the class claims, the worst case scenario was that the court simply remanded it back to the district court to make the necessary corrections. I don't think that's necessary in this particular case. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.